Below, the worms dove beneath the mounded sand, where they tested the boundaries of the hold. Shiana watched them in their restless motion, wondering how much they understood of their strange situation. If Leto II was indeed inside those creatures, he must be having troubled dreams. Some like to live in complacency, hoping for stability without upset. I much prefer to turn over rocks and see what scurries out. Mother Superior Odraid, Observations on Honored Matre Motivations. Even after so many years, the Ithaca divulged its secrets like old bones rising to the surface of a battlefield after a drenching rain. The old Bashar had stolen this great vessel from Gamu long ago. Duncan was held prisoner aboard it for over a decade on the Chapter House landing field, and they had been flying for 3 years now. But the Ithaca's immense size and the small number of people aboard made it impossible to explore all its mysteries, much less keep a diligent watch everywhere. The vessel, a compact city over a kilometer in diameter, was more than 100 decks high, with uncounted passageways and rooms. Although the main decks and compartments were equipped with surveillance imagers, it was beyond the sisters' capacity to monitor the entire no-ship, especially since it had mysterious electronic dead zones where the imagers did not function. Perhaps the honored Matres or the original builders of the vessel had installed blocking devices to preserve certain secrets. Numerous code-locked doors had remained unopened since the ship left Gamu. There were, literally, thousands of chambers that no one had entered or inventoried. Nevertheless, Duncan did not expect to discover a long-sealed death chamber on one of the rarely visited decks. The lift tube paused at one of the deep central levels. Although he had not requested this floor, the doors opened as the tube took itself out of service for a series of self-maintenance procedures, which the old ship performed automatically. Duncan studied the deck in front of him, noted that it was cold and barren, dimly lit, unoccupied. The metal walls had been painted with no more than a white primer layer that didn't completely cover the rough surfaced metal underneath. He'd known about these unfinished levels, but had never felt the need to investigate them, because he assumed they were abandoned or never used. However, the honored Matres had owned this ship for years before Teg stole it from under their noses. Duncan should not have assumed anything. He stepped out of the lift tube and wandered alone down a long corridor that continued for a surprising distance. Exploring unknown decks and chambers was like making a blind fold space jump. He didn't know where he would end up. As he walked, he randomly opened chambers. Doors slid aside to reveal dim, empty rooms. From the dust and lack of furnishings, he guessed that no one had ever occupied them. At the center of the deck level, a short corridor circled an enclosed section that had 2 doors, each marked machinery room. The doors did not open at his touch. Curious, Duncan studied the locking mechanism. His own bioprint had been keyed into the ship's systems, supposedly granting him complete access. Using a master code, he overrode the door controls and forced open the seals. When he stepped inside, he instantly detected a different quality to the darkness, an unpleasant, long-faded odor in the air. The chamber was unlike any other he had seen aboard the ship, its walls a bright, discordant red. The splash of violent color was jarring. Driving back his uneasiness, he spotted what looked like a patch of exposed metal on one wall. Duncan passed a hand over it, and abruptly the entire center section of the chamber began to slide and turn over with a groan. As he stepped out of the way, Ominous-looking devices came up from the floor, machines manufactured for the sole purpose of inflicting pain. Honored Matre, torture devices. The lights in the dim chamber came up as if in eager anticipation. To his right, he saw an austere table and hard, flat chairs. Dirty dishes strewn on the table with what looked like the crusted, unfinished remains of a meal. The whores must have been interrupted while eating. One machine in the array still held a human skeleton bound together with dry sinews, thorny wires, and the rags of a black robe. Female. The bones hung from the side of a large, stylized vise. The victim's entire arm was still caught in the compression mechanism. Touching long dormant controls, Duncan opened the vise. With great care and respect, he removed the crumbling body from the harsh metal embrace and lowered it to the deck. Mostly mummified, she weighed little. It was clearly a Bene Gesserit captive, perhaps a reverend mother from one of the sisterhood planets the whores had destroyed. Duncan could tell that the unfortunate victim had not died quickly or easily. Looking at the withered, iron-hard lips, he could almost hear the curses the woman must have whispered as the honored Matres killed her. Under the increased illumination from the glow panels, Duncan continued to explore the large room and its labyrinth of odd machines. Near the door through which he had entered, he found a clear plas bin, its grisly contents visible. Four more female skeletons, all piled in disarray, as if thrown unceremoniously inside. Killed and discarded. All of them wore black robes. No matter how much pain they had inflicted, the honored Matres would not have gotten the information they demanded. The location of Chapter House and the key to Bene Gesserit bodily control. The ability of a reverend mother to manipulate her own internal chemistry. Frustrated and infuriated, the whores would have killed their Bene Gesserit prisoners one by one. Duncan pondered his discovery in silence. Words did not seem adequate. Best to tell Shiana about this terrible room. As a reverend mother, she would know what to do. Learn how to recognize your greatest enemy. It may even be yourself. Mother Commander Mirbella, Chapter House Archives. After executing the defiant honored Matre, Mirbella was in no hurry to meet the guild delegation. She wanted to make sure all traces of the disturbance were cleaned up before any outsiders were allowed into the keep's main chamber. These little rebellions were like brush fires. As soon as she stamped one out, others flared up elsewhere. Until her rule was strong and unchallenged on Chapter House, the Mother Commander could not turn her efforts to bringing the dissident honored Matre cells on other planets into the new sisterhood. And she had to accomplish that before they could all stand against the unknown, oncoming enemy that had driven honored Matres from the fringes of the scattering. To succeed against the ultimate threat, she would need the Spacing Guild, and they had already proved to be insufficiently motivated. She would change that. Each step of the overall plan hummed past like connected cars on a maglev train. Belanda shuffled to the foot of the dais below Mirbella's ornamented chair. She demonstrated a businesslike, efficient manner with just the right amount of deference. Mother Commander, the guild delegation grows impatient. As you intended. I believe they are ripe for your meeting. Mirbella regarded the obese woman. Since Bene Gesserits were able to control the most minute nuances of their body chemistry, the fact that Belanda let herself become so fat carried a message of its own. A sign of rebellion? flaunting her lack of interest in being viewed as a sexual figure? Some might consider it a slap at the honored matres, who used more traditional methods to hone their bodies to wiry perfection. Mirbella, though, suspected that Belanda used her obesity to distract and lull any potential opponents. Assuming her to be slow and weak, they would underestimate her. But Mirbella knew better. "Bring me spice coffee. I must be at my sharpest. Those guildsmen will no doubt attempt to manipulate me. Shall I send them in now? My coffee first, then the guild. And summon Doria as well. I want both of you beside me." With a knowing smile, Belanda lumbered away. Preparing herself, Mirbella sat forward in her great chair and squared her shoulders. Her hands gripped the hard and silky smooth sue stones on the throne's arms. After years of violence, all the men she had enslaved and the women she had killed, she knew how to look intimidating. As soon as Mirbella had her coffee, she nodded to Belanda. The old sister touched a communications stub in her ear, called for the guild supplicants. Doria hurried in, knowing she was late. The ambitious young woman, who currently served as the Mother Commander's key advisor from the Honored Matre faction, had risen in rank by killing close rivals, while other Honored Matres wasted time on duels with competing Bene Gesserits. The whip-thin Doria had recognized the emerging patterns of power and decided she would rather be deputy to the victor than leader of the vanquished. "Take your places on either side of me. Who is the formal representative? Did the guild send someone of particular importance?" Mirbella knew only that the guild delegation had come to the new sisterhood begging for an audience with her. Prior to the Battle of Junction, not even the guild knew the location of Chapter House. The sisterhood kept their home world hidden behind a moat of no ships, its coordinates in no guild navigation record. However, once the floodgates were opened and honored matres had arrived in droves, the location of Chapter House was no longer a closely held secret. Even so, few outsiders came directly to the keep. "Their highest human administrative official," Doria said in a hard, flinty voice, "and a navigator." "A navigator?" Even Belanda sounded surprised. "Here?" Scowling at her counterpart, Doria continued. "I've received reports from the docking center where the guild ship landed. He's an Edric-class navigator bearing the gene markers of an old bloodline." Mirbella's wide forehead creased. She sifted through direct knowledge as well as information that had surfaced from the chain of other memories inside her head. "An administrator and a navigator." She allowed a cold smile. "The guild must have an important message indeed." "Maybe it is no more than groveling, Mother Commander," Belanda said. "The guild is desperate for spies." "And well they should be," Doria snapped. She and Belanda were always at odds, though their heated debates occasionally produced interesting perspectives. At the moment, Mirbella found it sophomoric. "Enough, both of you. I will not allow the guildsmen to see you bickering. Such childish displays demonstrate weakness." Both advisors fell silent as if a gate had slammed shut across their mouths. As the hall's great doors swung open, female attendants stepped aside to allow the delegation of gray-robed men to enter. The newcomers' bodies were squat, the heads hairless, their faces slightly malformed and wrong. The guild did not breed with an eye to physical perfection or attractiveness. They focused on the human mind, on maximizing its potential. At their lead strode a tall, silver-robed man, whose bald head was as smooth as polished marble, except for a white braid that dangled from the base of his skull like a long electrical cord. The administrative official stopped to survey the room with milky eyes, though he did not seem to be blind, then stepped forward to clear a path for the bulky construction that followed. Behind the guildsmen levitated a great armored aquarium, a transparent, distorted bubble of a tank filled with orange spice gas. Heavy scrolled metalwork reached up like support ribs against the tank. Through the thick plaz, Mirbella observed a misshapen form, no longer quite human, its limbs wasted and thin, as if the body was little more than a stem to support the expanded mind. The Navigator. Mirbella rose from her throne as a sign that she looked down upon this delegation, not as a gesture of respect. She wondered how many times such grand representatives had presented themselves before political leaders and emperors, browbeating them with the Spacing Guild's mighty monopoly on space travel. This time, though, she sensed a difference. The Navigator, the High Administrator, and five guildsmen escorts came as cowed supplicants. While the gray-robed escorts lowered their faces from her gaze, the braided representative put himself in front of the Navigator's tank and bowed before her. "I am Administrator Rentel Goris. We represent the Spacing Guild." "Obviously," Mirbella said coolly. As if afraid of being upstaged, the Navigator drifted to the curved front pane of his tank. His voice was distorted from speaker translators in the metal support ribs. "Mother Superior of the Bene Gesserit, or do we address you as Great Honored Matre?" Mirbella knew that most navigators were so isolated and obscure they could barely communicate with normal humans. With brains as folded as the fabric of space, they could not utter a comprehensible sentence and communed instead with their even more bizarre and exotic oracle of time. Some navigators, however, clung to shreds of their genetic past, intentionally stunting themselves so they could act as liaisons with mere humans. "You may address me as Mother Commander, provided you do so with respect. What is your name, Navigator?"
"I am Edric. Many in my line have interacted with governments and individuals, dating back to the time of Emperor Muad'Dib."
He swam closer to the walls of his tank, and she could see the otherworldly eyes set in his large, misshapen head.
"I am less interested in history than in your present predicament," Mirbella said, choosing to use the steel of the honored matres rather than the cool negotiating manner of the Bene Gesserits.
Administrator Goris continued to bow as if speaking to the floor at Mirbella's feet.
"With the destruction of Rakis, all of its sandworms died, and thus the desert planet produces no more spice. Compounding the problem, honored matres slew the old Tliloxu masters, so the secret of creating spice from axolotl tanks has been lost."
"Quite a quandary," Doria muttered with a bit of a sneer. Mirbella curled her own lips downward in a frown. She remained on her feet.
"You state these things as if we did not know them."
The Navigator continued, amplifying his voice in order to drown out further words from Goris.
"In days past, melange was plentiful and we had numerous independent sources. Now, after little more than a decade, the Guild has only its own stockpiles remaining, and they are dwindling rapidly. It is becoming difficult to obtain spice even on the black market."
Mirbella crossed her arms over her chest. On either side of her, Belanda and Doria looked supremely satisfied. But we can provide you with new spice, if we choose to do so, if you give us good reason. Edric drifted in his tank. The escort party of guildsmen looked away. The desert band girdling Chapter House was continuing to expand every year. Spice blows had occurred, and the stunted sandworms were growing larger, though they were only shadows of the monsters that once churned the dunes of Rakkis. Decades ago, before the honored Matres obliterated Dune, the Bene Gesserit Order had gathered huge stockpiles of the then plentiful spice. In contrast, the Spacing Guild, assuming the days of scarce melange were long over and the market was strong, did not make preparations for a possible shortage. Even the ancient trading conglomerate of Chome had been caught off guard. Mirbella stepped closer to the tank, focused on the navigator. Goris folded his hands and said to her, "The reason we have come is therefore obvious, Mother Commander." Mirbella said, "My sisters and I have good reason for cutting off your supplies." Nonplussed, Edric waved his webbed hands in the swirling mists. "Mother Commander, what have we done to invoke your displeasure?" She lifted her thin eyebrows in scorn. "Your guild knew that honored Matres bore weapons from the scattering that were capable of destroying entire planets. And you still transported the whores against us." "Honored Matres had their own ships from the scattering. Their own technologies," Goris began. "But they flew blind, did not know the landscape of the old empire until you guided them. The guild showed them their targets, led them to vulnerable worlds. The guild is complicit in the eradication of billions of lives, not just on Rakkis itself, but on our library world of Lampetus and countless other planets. All the worlds of the Bene Tleilachs have been crushed or conquered, while our own sisters remain enslaved on Boozle, harvesting Sue stones for rebelled honored Matres who will not bow to my rule." She laced her fingers together. "The Spacing Guild is at least partly responsible for those crimes, so you must make recompense." "Without spice, space travel and all galactic commerce will be hobbled." Alarm rang clearly in Administrator Goris's voice. "So? The guild has previously flaunted its alliance with the Ixians by using primitive navigation machines. Use them instead of navigators if your supply of spice is inadequate." She waited to see if he would call her bluff. "Inferior substitutes," Edric insisted. Belanda added, "Ships in the scattering flew without spice or navigators." "Countless numbers were lost," Edric said. Goris was quick to change his voice to a conciliatory tone. "Mother Commander, the Ixian machines were mere fallback devices to be used in emergencies only. We have never relied on them. All guild ships must carry a functional navigator. So, when you showed off these machines, it was all a sham to drive down the price of melange? To convince the priests of the divided god and the Tleilaxu that you didn't need what they were selling?" Her lips curled in disdain. During the years that Chapter House was hidden, even the Bene Gesserits had shunned guild ships. The sisters held the location of their planet in their own minds. "And now that you do require spice, there is no one to sell it to you. No one but us." Mirbella had her own deceptions. The extravagant use of mélange on Chapter House was mainly for show. A bluff. So far, the worms in the desert belt provided only a trickle of spice, but the Bene Gesserit kept the market open by freely selling mélange from their copious stockpiles, implying that it came from the newborn worms in the arid belt. Eventually, the Chapter House desert would indeed be as rich in spice as the sands of Rakkis, but for now, the Sisterhood's ruse was necessary to increase the perception of power and limitless wealth. And somewhere, eventually, there would be other planets producing mélange. Before the long night of the honored Matres, Mother Superior Odraid had dispersed groups of sisters in unguided no-ships across uncharted space. They had carried sand trout specimens and clear instructions on how to seed new desert worlds. Right now, there might already be more than a dozen alternative dunes being created out there. "Remove the single point of failure," Odraid often said then and afterward from other memory. The spice bottleneck would once again be gone, and fresh sources of mélange would appear throughout the galaxy. For now, though, the iron grip of monopoly was the new Sisterhood's. Goris bowed even more deeply, refusing to raise his milky eyes. "Mother Commander, we will pay whatever you wish." "Then you shall pay with your suffering. Have you ever heard of a Bene Gesserit punishment?" She drew a long, cool breath of air. "Your request is denied. Navigator Edric and Administrator Goris, you may tell your Oracle of Time and your fellow navigators that the Guild will have more spice when, and if, I decide you warrant it." She felt a warmth of satisfaction and guessed that it came from Odraid within. When they were hungry enough, the Guild would be prepared to do exactly as she wished. It was all part of a great plan coming together. Trembling, Goris said, "Can your new sisterhood survive without the Guild? We could bring a huge force of Highliners and take the spice from you." Mirbella smiled to herself, knowing his threat had no teeth. "Accepting your ludicrous assertion for a moment, would you risk destroying the spice forever? We have installed explosives, cleverly rigged to annihilate the spice sands and flood them out with our water reserves if we detect even the slightest incursion from outside. The last sandworms would die." "You're as bad as Paul Atreides," the guildsman cried. "He made a similar threat against the Spacing Guild." "I take that as a compliment." Mirbella looked at the confused navigator floating in his spice gas. The administrator's bald head glistened with sweat. Now she addressed the five gray-clothed guildsman escorts. "Raise your eyes to me, all of you." The escorts turned their faces upward, revealing collective fear. Goris snapped his head up as well, and the navigator pressed his mutated face against the transparent plaz. Although Mirbella spoke to the guild contingent, her words were also meant for the two factions of women who listened in the great hall. "Selfish fools. There is a greater danger coming. An enemy that was powerful enough to drive the honored Matres back from the scattering. We all know this." "We have all heard this, Mother Commander." The administrator's voice dripped with skepticism. "We have seen no proof." Her eyes flashed. "Oh, yes. They are coming. But the threat is so vast that no one, not the new Sisterhood, nor the Spacing Guild, nor Chome, nor even the honored Matres, understand how to get out of the way. We have weakened ourselves and wasted our energies in meaningless struggles while ignoring the true threat. She swirled her serpent-scribed robe. If the Guild provides us with sufficient assistance in the coming battle, with sufficient enthusiasm, perhaps I will reconsider opening our stockpiles to you. If we cannot stand against the relentless enemy, then bickering over spice will be the least of our problems. Do the masters truly control the strings? Or can we use the strings to ensnare the masters? Tliloxu Master Aleph, presumed to be a face dancer replica. Face dancer representatives came to a conference chamber aboard one of the guild ships used by the lost Tliloxu. The face dancers had been summoned by the breeding wizards from the scattering to receive explicit new instructions. Second rank Uxtal attended the meeting as a note taker and observer. He did not intend to speak, since speaking would earn him a reprimand from his betters. He wasn't important enough to bear such a responsibility, especially with the equivalent of a master present, one of those who called themselves elders. But Uxtal was confident they would recognize his talent sooner or later. A faithful Tliloxu, he was gray-skinned and diminutive, his features elfin, his flesh impregnated with metals and blockers to foil any scanners. No one could steal the secrets of genetics, the language of God, from the lost Tliloxu. Like an oversized elf, Elder Bura perched on his raised seat at the head of the table as face dancers began to arrive one at a time. Eight of them, an ancient and sacred number to the Tliloxu, which Uxtal had learned from studying scriptures and deciphering secret Gnostic meanings in the preserved words of the prophet. Though Elder Bura had commanded the shapeshifters to appear, Uxtal had an uneasy feeling in their presence, one that he could not quite put into thoughts or words. The face dancers looked like completely nondescript, average crewmen. Over the years, they had been planted aboard the guild ship, where they performed their duties quietly and efficiently. Not even the guild suspected that replacements had occurred. This new breed of face dancers had extensively infiltrated the remnants of the old empire. They could fool most tests, even one of the witch's truthsayers. Bura and other lost Tliloxu leaders often snickered that they had achieved their victory, while the honored Matres and Bene Gesserits scrambled around preparing for some mysterious great enemy. The real invasion was already well underway, and Uxtal was awed and impressed with what his people had accomplished. He was proud to be among them. At Bura's command, the face dancers took their seats, deferring to one who seemed to be their spokesman, though Uxtal had thought that all of those creatures were identical, like drones in an insect hive. Watching them, scribbling notes, he wondered for the first time if face dancers might have their own secret organization, as the Tliloxu leaders did. No, of course not. The shapeshifters were bred to be followers, not independent thinkers. Uxtal paid close attention, remembering not to speak. Later he would transcribe this meeting and disseminate the information to other elders of the lost Tliloxu. His job was to serve as an assistant. If he performed well enough, he could rise through the ranks, eventually achieving the title of elder among his people. Could there be a grander dream? One of the new masters. Elder Bura and the present Kale, or Council, represented the lost Tliloxu race and their great belief. Besides Bura, only six elders existed, a total of seven, while eight was the holy number. Though he would never speak it aloud, Uxtal felt they should appoint someone else soon, or even promote him, so that the prescribed numbers were in proper balance. As he surveyed the face dancers, Bura's lips pressed together in a petulant frown. I demand a report on your progress. What records have you salvaged from the destroyed Tliloxu worlds? We barely know enough of their technology to continue with the sacred work. Our fallen stepbrothers knew much more than we have recovered. This is not acceptable. The placid-looking leader of the face dancers smiled in his guildsman's uniform. He addressed his shapeshifter comrades as if he hadn't even heard Elder Bura speak. I have received our next set of commands. Our primary instructions remain the same. We are to find the no-ship that escaped from Chapter House. The search must continue. To Uxtal's surprise, the other face dancers turned away from Bura, focusing instead on their own spokesman. Flustered, the elder pounded a small fist on the table. An escaped no-ship? What do we care about a no-ship? Who are you? Which one? I can never tell you apart, not even by scent. The face dancer leader looked at Bura and seemed to consider whether or not to answer the question. At the moment, I am called Crone. Sitting against the copper-plated wall, Uxtal flicked his gaze from the innocent-looking face dancers to Elder Bura. He couldn't grasp the undercurrents here, but he sensed a strange threat. So many things were just slightly beyond the edge of his comprehension. Your priority, Bura doggedly continued, is to rediscover how to manufacture melange using axolotl tanks. From old knowledge we took with us into the scattering, we know how to use the tanks to create golas, but not to make spice. A technique that our stepbrothers developed during the famine times, long after our line of Tliloxu departed. When the lost Tliloxu returned from the scattering, their stepbrothers had accepted them only hesitantly, allowing them back into the fold of their race as no more than second-class citizens. Uxtal didn't think it was fair. But he and his fellow outsiders, all of them prodigal sons according to the original Tliloxu, accepted the deprecatory comments they received, remembering an important quote from the Catechism of the Great Belief. Only those who are truly lost can ever hope to find the truth. Trust not in your maps, but in the guidance of God. As time passed, the returned elders came to see that it was not they who were lost, but the original masters who had strayed from the great belief. Only the lost Tliloxu, forged in the rigors of the scattering, had kept the veracity of God's commands, while the heretical ones wallowed in delusions. Eventually, the lost Tliloxu had realized that they would have to re-educate their misguided brothers or remove them. Uxtal understood, having been told so many times that the lost Tliloxu were far superior. The original masters were a suspicious lot, however, and they had never entirely trusted outsiders, not even outsiders of their own race. In this case, their problematic paranoia had not been misguided, for the lost Tliloxu were indeed in league with the honored Matres. They used the terrible women as tools for reasserting the great belief upon their complacent stepbrothers. The whores had wiped out the original Tliloxu worlds, eliminating every last original master. A more extreme reaction than Uxtal had anticipated. Victory should have been simple enough to achieve. During this meeting, however, Crone and his fellows were not acting as expected. In the copper-walled meeting chamber, Uxtal noticed subtle changes in their demeanor and saw the concern on Elder Bura's face. Our priorities are different from yours, Crone said baldly. Uxtal stifled a gasp. Bura was so displeased that his grayish expression turned a bruised purple. Different priorities. How could any orders supersede mine, an elder of the Tliloxu? He laughed with a sound like dull metal scraped across slate. Oh, now I remember that silly story. Do you mean your mysterious old man and old woman who communicate with you from afar? Yes, Crone said. According to their projections, the escaped no-ship holds something or someone supremely important to them. We must find it, capture it, and deliver it to them. Uxtal found this all so incomprehensible that he had to speak up. What old man and old woman? No one ever told him the things he needed to know. Bura glanced dismissively at his assistant. Face dancer delusions. Crone looked down at the elder as if he were a maggot. Their projections are infallible. Aboard that no-ship is, or will be, the necessary fulcrum to influence the battle at the end of the universe. That takes precedence over your need for a convenient source of spice.
But how do they know this?
Uxtal asked, surprised that he was finding the nerve to speak.
Is it a prophecy?
He tried to imagine a numerical code that might apply, one buried in the sacred writings. Bura snapped at him.
Prophecy, prescience, or some sort of bizarre mathematical projection. It does not matter.
As Crone stood, he seemed to grow taller. On the contrary, you do not matter. He turned to his fellow face dancers while the elder sat in speechless shock. We must turn our minds and our efforts to discovering where that vessel has gone. We are everywhere, but it has been 3 years and the trail has grown cold. The other 7 shapeshifters nodded, speaking in a sort of rapid, humming undertone that sounded like the buzz of insects. We will find them. They cannot escape. The tachyon net extends far and it draws tighter. The no-ship will be found.
I do not give you permission for this foolish search, Bura shouted.
Uxtal wanted to cheer for him.
You will heed my commands. I told you to scour the conquered Tliloxu planets, investigate the laboratories of the fallen masters, and learn their methods of creating spice with axolotl tanks. Not only do we require it for ourselves, but it is a priceless commodity that we can use to break the Bene Gesserit monopoly and claim the commercial power that is our due.
He delivered this grand speech as if expecting the face dancers to stand up and shout their approval.
No, Crone said emphatically. That is not our intention.
Uxtal remained aghast. He himself had never dreamed of challenging an elder, and this was a mere face dancer. He shrank back against the coppery wall, wishing he could melt into it. This wasn't the way things were supposed to happen. Angry and confused, Bura twisted back and forth in his chair.
We created face dancers, and you will follow our orders.
He sniffed and got to his feet.
Why am I even discussing this with you?
In unison, as if they shared a single mind, the entire contingent of face dancers stood. From their positions around the table, they blocked Elder Bura's exit. He sat back down on his high seat, and now he seemed nervous.
Are you certain you lost Tliloxu created us? Or did you simply find us out in the scattering?
True. In the distant shadows of the past, A Tliloxu master was responsible for our seed stock. He made modifications and dispatched us to the ends of the universe shortly before the birth of Paul Muad'Dib. But we have evolved since then. As if a veil had been lifted simultaneously from their faces, Crone and his companions blurred and shifted. Their nondescript human expressions melted away, and the face dancers returned to their blank state, a bland yet unnervingly inhuman set of features. Sunken black button eyes, pug noses, slack mouths. Their skin was pale and malleable, their vestigial hair bristly and white. Using a genetic map, they could form their muscles and epidermis into any desired pattern to mimic humans. We no longer need to expend effort on continuing illusions, Crone announced. That deception has become a waste of time. Uxtal and Elder Burra stared at them. Crone continued, long ago, the original Tliloxu masters produced the genesis of what we have become. You, Elder Burra, and your fellows are but faded copies, diluted memories of your race's former greatness. It offends us that you consider yourselves our masters. Three of the face dancers moved toward the high seat of Elder Burra. Two stepped behind him and one on either side, closing him in. With each passing moment, the elder looked more afraid. Uxtal felt as if he would faint. He barely dared to breathe and wanted to flee, but knew there were many more face dancers aboard the guild ship than these eight. He would never escape alive.
Stop this! I command you!
Burra tried to stand up, but the two flanking face dancers held his slumped shoulders to keep him from leaving his elevated seat. Crone said, No wonder the others call you lost. You masters from the scattering have always been blind. Behind him, a third face dancer reached forward with both hands to cover Burra's eyes. Using his forefingers, the face dancer squeezed, pressing like an iron vice into Burra's skull. The elder screamed. His eyeballs burst. Blood and fluid ran down his cheeks. Crone let out a mild, artificial-sounding laugh. Maybe your Tliloxu companions could create old-fashioned metal eyes for you. Or have you lost that technology as well? Burra's continuing screams were abruptly cut short as the face dancer snapped the man's head to one side, breaking his neck. Within moments, the shapeshifter had taken a deep imprint. His body shifted, shrank, and acquired the elfin features of the dead elder. When the transition was complete, he flexed his small fingers and smiled down at the bloodied, identical body on the floor. Another one replaced, the face dancer said.
Another one?
Uxtal froze, trying to keep from screaming and wishing he could just become invisible. Now the shapeshifters turned to face the assistant. Unable to do more than cringe, he held up his hands in complete surrender, though he doubted that would do any good. They would kill him and replace him. No one would ever know. A quiet moan escaped from his throat. We will no longer pretend that you are our masters, Crone said to Uxtal. The face dancers stepped away from Burra's body. The copy bent down and wiped his bloody fingers on the crumpled elder's garment. However, for the overall plan, we still need to use certain Tliloxu procedures, and for that we will retain some of the original genetic stock, if you qualify. Crone stepped very close to Uxtal and stared hard at him. Do you understand the hierarchy here? Do you realize who is your true master? Uxtal managed no more than a hoarse gasp as he answered,
Yes,
of course. 3 years of wandering in this ship. Our people certainly comprehend the incredible search for the promised land. We will endure as we have always endured. We will be patient as we have always been patient. Still, the doubting voice within me asks, does anyone know where we are going? The rabbi, speech to his followers aboard the no ship. The Jewish passengers were given all the freedom they could desire aboard the giant vessel, but Shiana knew that every prison had its bars, and every camp its fences. The only reverend mother among the refugee Jews, a woman named Rebecca, sought out her boundaries, diligent and quietly curious. Shiana had always found her to be intriguing, a wild reverend mother, a woman who had undergone the agony without the benefit of Bene Gesserit training. The very idea amazed her, but other such anomalies had occurred throughout history. Shiana often accompanied Rebecca on her contemplative walks, each of which was more a journey of the mind than an effort to reach any specific room or deck. Are we just going to wander in circles again? The rabbi complained, tagging along. A former souk doctor, he always preferred to evaluate the point of an activity before engaging it. Why should I waste my time in futile pursuits when one can study the Word of God? The rabbi acted as if they were forcing him to walk along with them. To him, he had an obligation to study the Torah for the sake of study, but Shiana knew that Jewish women were to study for the sake of knowing the practical application of Torah law. Rebecca had gone far beyond either. All of life is a journey. We are carried along at life's pace, whether we choose to run or sit still, Shiana said. He scowled and looked to Rebecca for support, but found none. Don't quote your Bene Gesserit platitudes to me, he said. Jewish mysticism is far more ancient than anything you witches have developed. Would you rather I quoted your Kabbalah? Many of the other lives within me studied the Kabbalah extensively, even though they were technically not allowed to do so. Jewish mysticism is quite fascinating. The rabbi seemed nonplussed, as if she had stolen something from him. He pushed his spectacles higher on his nose and walked closer to Rebecca, trying to shut out Shiana. Whenever the old man joined their conversations, the debate became a clash between Shiana and the rabbi. The old man insisted on a battleground of scholarship rather than any direct wisdom Shiana carried within her from her myriad other memories. It made her feel practically invisible. Regardless of her clout aboard the no-ship, the rabbi did not consider her relevant to the concerns of his Jews, and Rebecca did well holding her own. Now they passed down the curving corridors, descending from one deck to another with Rebecca leading the way. She had bound her long brown hair into a thick braid that was shot with so many threads of gray that it resembled driftwood. She wore her usual loose, drab robe. The rabbi walked close beside her, jockeying his position in a not accidental attempt to shoulder Shiana behind the two of them. Shiana found it amusing. The rabbi never missed an opportunity to lecture Rebecca when her thoughts strayed from the narrow confines of what he considered proper behavior. He often browbeat Rebecca, reminding her that she was irretrievably tainted in his eyes because of what the Bene Gesserit had done to her. Regardless of the old man's scorn and concern, Shiana knew that Rebecca would always have the sisterhood's gratitude. Ages ago, the secret Jews had made a pact with the Bene Gesserit for mutual protection. The sisterhood had offered them sanctuary at times throughout history, hiding them, carrying them away from pogroms and prejudice after the violent tides of intolerance had once again swung against the children of Israel. In exchange, the Jews had been obligated to protect the Bene Gesserit sisters from the honored Matres. When the ferocious whores had come to the sisterhood's library world of Lampadas with the clear intention of destroying it, the Bene Gesserit had shared their own memories. Millions of lives poured into thousands of minds, and those thousands distilled into hundreds, and those hundreds all shared into one reverend mother, Lucilla, who escaped with that irreplaceable knowledge. Fleeing to Gamu, Lucilla had begged sanctuary from the hidden Jews, but the honored Matres came hunting after her. The only way to preserve the Lampadas hoard in her mind had been to share it with an unexpected recipient, the wild Reverend Mother Rebecca, and then to offer up Lucilla as a sacrifice. So Rebecca had accepted all those desperate, clamoring thoughts into her brain and preserved them even after the whores had killed Lucilla. She eventually delivered her priceless treasure to the Bene Gesserit, who accepted the rescued knowledge of Lampadas and distributed it widely among the women at Chapter House. Thus, the Jews had fulfilled their ancient obligations. A debt is a debt, Shiana thought. Honor is honor. Truth is truth. But she knew Rebecca was forever changed by the experience. How could she not be, after living the lives of millions of Bene Gesserits? Millions who thought differently, who experienced many astonishing things, who accepted behaviors and opinions that were anathema to the rabbi. No wonder Shiana and Rebecca frightened him, intimidated him. As for Rebecca, though she had shared those memories with others, she still carried the kaleidoscope chains of life after life, traveling backward into myriad pasts. How could she be expected to shrug that aside and return to mere memorized knowledge? She had lost her innocence. Even the rabbi must understand that. The old man had been Rebecca's teacher and mentor. Before Lampadas, she might have debated with him, sharpening wit and intellect, but she would never have doubted him. Shiana felt sorry for what the other woman had lost. Now, Rebecca must see the immense gaps in even the rabbi's understanding. To discover that one's mentor knows little is a terrible thing. The old man's view of the universe encompassed only the barest tip of an iceberg. The rabbi wore a white skull cap on his balding head as he walked along beside Rebecca with a fit and energetic stride. His dusky ship clothes hung loosely on his small frame, but he refused to have them refitted or new garments manufactured. His gray beard had grown paler in recent years, contrasting with his leathery skin, but he was still extremely healthy. Though the verbal sparring did not seem to bother Rebecca, Shiana had learned not to press the rabbi in philosophical debates beyond a certain point. Whenever he was about to lose an argument, the old man vehemently quoted some line from the Torah, whether or not he understood the meanings within meanings, and stalked away in feigned triumph. Rebecca had once confided to Shiana that she missed her prior, innocent relationship with the old man, but it could never be regained. The three of them wandered down deck after deck until they reached the no-ship's brig levels. This stolen vessel had been built by people from the scattering and flown by honored Matres, probably aided by the duplicitous spacing guild. Every large vessel, even from the days of sailing ships on the seas of near-forgotten Earth, contains secure cells for holding unruly people. The rabbi appeared nervous when he noticed where Rebecca had led them. Shiana certainly knew what was kept in the brig. Futars. How often did Rebecca visit the creatures? Half-beasts. Shiana wondered if the whores had used these brig cells as torture chambers, like in an ancient Bastille, or had dangerous prisoners been kept aboard this vessel? Dangerous. None could be more dangerous than these four Futars. Beast men created in the shadows of the scattering, muscular hybrids as close to animals as they were to humans. They were born hunters with wiry hair, long fangs, and sharp claws, animals bred to track down and kill. Why do we go down here, daughter? What is it you seek from these inhuman things? I always seek answers, Rabbi. An honorable pursuit, Shiana said from behind them. He spun to snap at her. Some answers should never be learned. And some answers help protect us from the unknown, Rebecca said, but it was clear by her voice that she knew she would never convince him. Rebecca and Shiana stopped in front of the transparent wall of one of the holding chambers, though the rabbi now hovered a step behind them. Shiana always found herself intrigued and disgusted by the Futars. Even in their confinement, they maintained their muscular physiques, prowling and pacing. The beasts moved about aimlessly, separated by brig walls, circling from side wall to plaza doorway to back wall, and then around again, testing and retesting boundaries. Predators are optimists, Shiana realized. They have to be. She could see their stored energy, their primitive needs. The Futars longed to lope through a forest again, to track down prey and sink claws and fangs into unresisting flesh. During a battle on Gamu, the Jewish refugees had run to the Bene Gesserit forces demanding the protection accorded them by the old agreement. At the same time, four escaped Futars had come aboard, asking to be taken to handlers. Afterward, the predatory half-human creatures had been held on the no-ship.